Okay, good evening everybody and welcome to this evening's teleseminar called How to Overcome Adversity. My name is Damien Sen and it's a great pleasure to have you on the line this evening. In a few moments from now I'll be introducing our very special guest, Richard McCann. But before I do that, I thought I'd take a couple of moments up front to share how this call will work this evening, particularly if this is your first PeopleYouShouldMeet.com call that you've tuned into. Now, we're going to be on the call for around about an hour this evening, and over the course of the hour, I will be asking Richard a whole series of different questions on our topic. Some of the questions will be my own, but the vast majority of the questions will have actually come from your questions submitted prior to the call. Now, the whole topic of adversity was a topic that I personally felt very inspired to explore in the PeopleYouShouldMeet.com calls, because I know adversity or tough times or challenges can actually have a very isolating effect. So I guess through exploring some of the aspects of adversity, I thought it would really give people an opportunity to realize that we're all with challenge at some level through our human experience. And it's actually through looking at the challenges of other people that we can actually realize that we're not separate and that we're not alone, that we're actually very connected on this planet Earth. Now, our guest Richard McCann is no stranger to adverse situations and adverse circumstances in life. He had an incredibly tough childhood, and he's really managed to actually totally transform those tough circumstances into a life that today is remarkable. Now, I first met Richard through a very close friend of mine, Nikki Pattinson, very briefly a couple of years ago, but it's only been quite recently that I've had an opportunity to really explore Richard's work, and I've certainly been very, very inspired by it and very touched by it, and it really gives me great pleasure to welcome him to the call this evening. Now, Richard, an international best-selling author, his first book, Just a Boy, has sold over 400,000 copies around the world, and he's also a motivational speaker, bringing a positive and empowering message to people around the world. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the call Richard McCann. How are you doing, Richard?
I'm fine. Good evening, David. Thanks for having me on the show this evening.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you. Now, Richard, I'm just going to start us off at the start. I mentioned in the intro that you grew up in very difficult circumstances early in life. And I was just wondering if you could share with people a little bit about your story of your early life, to create a context for the call.
Yeah, they do say that the first 5 years of your life got an influence on where you end up in life. And I guess the first 5 years of my life were tough. We were brought up on the at-risk register. Mum and Dad weren't doing a very good job of bringing us up. Dad was very violent. We'd had over 100 visits by the social workers by the time I was five. And my dad actually left when I was four. And then Mum had a string of boyfriends, all of which were violent. One of them, the one she spent most time with, fed me and my elder sister Sonia drugs. We were both hallucinating. In fact, my elder sister was abused by him, and Mum received lots of beatings by him, and he was actually arrested for that and spent some time in prison. So things were tough anyway, and just when I thought they couldn't get any worse, they did, because a week before my sixth birthday, Mum went out for a night on the town, and she didn't arrive home. I mean, she was a big drinker, my mum, and the following morning after she didn't come home, me and my elder sister Sonia went walking the streets looking for her. It was 5:30, but it was like pitch black and we were scared. And it was the first time I felt fear. What we didn't know was that my mum's body was laid yards from where we walked on this path on the field at the back of the house. And I went on to learn or to discover that my mum had been murdered that night in the early hours by a man called Peter Sutcliffe. I know you've got listeners from around the world, but Peter Sutcliffe became a serial killer. My mum was the first to die. And I guess that experience sent me down a path I was not expecting to be going down, and to some degree shaped where I was going to go. And, we were placed in a children's home and for a few months, and then with my father, who became very violent. And I guess for the next 5 years or so, when Mum's girl was out there killing more and more women, I was just a real mess and was convinced that it was going to kill me, and I needed somebody to talk to, and I wasn't really given that opportunity. And you know, while mum's killers out there killing more and more women, my dad became more and more violent. And I mean, I have to say, he wasn't always violent. You know, 95% of the time he was fine. But when he was drinking whiskey out of the bottle, he just became this monster. And so subsequently, I had no self-esteem, no confidence, and I felt like damaged goods. You know, everybody else was better than me, and yeah, I was having suicidal thoughts and whatnot. But I guess, you know, mum's killer was finally arrested, so I no longer feared that he was going to kill me. But I guess I went through the next few years, yeah, trying the best I could, I suppose, trying to put it behind me, but I hadn't dealt with it. And trying to brush it under the carpet, started turning to glue and sniffing aerosol cans, and decided at the age of 16, finally, that I would leave school without taking my exams, and I left home. I walked out of my dad, and I actually moved in with my sister, Sonia, who by now had a flat. And I tried to make a life for myself. I guess that, in a nutshell, it was my early years. As dark as it all sounds, one of the things that I remember is I'd have this little conversation with myself. I'd have laid in bed, you know, my dad would send us to bed for whatever triviality. I remember saying to myself, as like eight-year-old boy, that, don't worry, Richard, because when you're older, you'll be able to help people around the world with your experiences. Now, I wasn't quite sure how I was going to do that, but I told myself that, and it was almost like it made my situation easier to deal with if I thought in that way. And when I look back at that, which I often do, I wonder, where did that come from? Because I've not listened to any speakers, and I've not read any books, but it was something within me that helped me deal with.
Wow, that's quite remarkable.
The 6-year-old boy, that she was taken as a sacrifice to give me a better life. I told myself that, and it just made it easier to deal with. And that kind of mindset has been with me ever since.
Wow. Did you have an awareness of what was actually going on around you, or were you too young?
At home? No, I mean, I couldn't comprehend. In fact, I didn't even know about murder. All I knew was something's not right here. Mum's always home, even if it is the middle of the night. She always came home for us. So when she wasn't there at 5:30, I had this feeling, this uncomfortable feeling that I've not felt before, that something's just not right. And as we went and sat and waited at the bus stop, and this fear that I felt grew worse and worse, you know, as each bus came and went, and there was no sign of my mum. And even when we were taken to the children's home, we were told by a police officer that mum had been taken to heaven, we weren't going to see her again. Even though being told that, I didn't actually understand at that age that I was never going to see her again. In fact, I started praying, and I thought, oh, if I pray hard enough, she'll be brought back. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that I actually discovered how my mum died. I mean, she was stabbed 14 times and hit twice over the head with a hammer. I can almost say that now as if it didn't happen, because I've heard it and read it so many times. Nobody sat me down and told me what happened. I had to read about it in the papers when it became this massive media story. Which was a bit difficult to deal with. And, you know, I mean, when people don't tell you what's really gone on, you've got, you know, it's easy to fall into that trap of making out a situation worse than what it is, which is why I became convinced he was actually going to kill me, because nobody sat me down and, you know, told me that I was in a safe place and that he wasn't actually going to come after me. The rest is history, almost.
No, it's one thing to go through traumatic experience, but to actually then stand up and share it with other people is something entirely different. And I was just wondering, Richard, if you could actually share, what was it that actually moved you to actually write about your experiences as a kid?
Well, yeah, I have to say, by the way, writing... Well, first of all, being associated with this serial killer, my family, and the way my mum was portrayed in the papers... It was always something that I was ashamed of. You know, what are people thinking about my mum? What are people thinking about my family? So I was always ashamed of it. And I tried to hide it, to be honest with you. I never broadcast it. But if somebody ever asked me about it, I would never deny it. So I was ashamed of that. But in 2002, And by the way, from the age of 16 to 2002 wasn't easy. And I'm not trying to say I started that new life and everything was okay. You know, I went down the wrong path a couple of times. I was kicked out of the army. I got involved in drugs, ended up in prison. And so it was tough, you know, as a young adult it was tough as well. But in 2002, when it all appeared to be coming back together, my sister Sonia stabbed a boyfriend in self-defense. Now, my sister Sonia has always had a string of very violent men, probably something to do with my dad's behavior. But when she did that, I knew that I had to do something about it. And I mean, some people said to me, because he was a violent boyfriend, why didn't you go hit him? Well, yeah, I could have done that. But I decided, no, I'm going to write a book about my life. And because Sonia has always played a big part in my life, I thought, it almost felt like I was writing a probationary report so that when she went to court for stabbing this person, they didn't die, by the way, that maybe the judge would find out what she'd been through and it would reduce the sentence. So that's how the book came about. And thankfully, the charges for Sonia were dropped by the police. It wasn't in the public interest. But I found it very cathartic to write about what I'd been through. And I continued writing the book anyway. And I have to say, Damon, it was the most liberating thing I've ever done. But terrifying as well, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But sometimes you have to do these things that terrifies. And I'm so glad that I did.
Well, and was it a free-flowing experience? Did the words just come out? Or was it a work that took some time to actually nurture out of you?
No, I found it quite easy to go into the... I started writing, and well, actually, I started remembering what I thought would make a book. So I was writing other bullet points down, and then I started putting them into a date order chronologically, and then I started writing. But once I started writing, I found that things I'd forgotten about returned, that I brushed under the carpet, and so there was actually lots in there, and much of it was actually edited out. But I didn't find it upsetting as I wrote it, but I actually found it upsetting when I got to the very end. I remember the Saturday afternoon, I thought, my God, that's what I went through. And but anyway, it was very liberating for me, and probably one of the best things I ever did. Not the best thing.
Amazing. And the work itself has had a phenomenal effect on people around the world. And I was just wondering, closer to home, how did it actually impact on your other family members?
Well, I have to say that, I mean, I'm not going to pretend that everybody was happy that I'd wrote it. Now, I've got three sisters, and one of them in particular, Donna, wasn't happy that I'd wrote the book. She felt as I was writing things about her, but, you know, but she didn't give me the opportunity to do that. So she actually went to the papers and tried to blacken my character, but and we never got on much, me and Donna, anyway, but she's come round... to the book now, and she understands why I did it, and we're actually best of friends now. So and obviously my dad, who doesn't come out very well in the book, wasn't happy that I'd wrote the book, but due to a certain thing that's happened in the last few months, in the last year or so, me and my dad have been brought closer together, so almost like everything's turned out for the best in the end.
It's creating a space for healing for everyone, just through the delivery of the book. Now, I can only imagine that you had many, many tough days through the whole experience. Was there a day in particular that really stood out as the hardest day of your life?
Yeah, you see, I mean, I would expect to say the night my mum died, but I'm not going to say that because I was so young. I actually didn't understand what was going on at the time. And if it happened to me as an adult, I would certainly say that that was the worst day of my life. But it wasn't. I think the worst day of my life was the 19th of December 2007, when my sister Sonia unfortunately took her life. The thing that I've always been fearing that she would do, she did. And I'll never forget that phone call. And that journey, I mean, I wasn't even told. I was just told to come, you know, but get to Sonia's house. I knew something had happened. That would have to be the worst day of my life. That journey I will never forget, driving through the city of Leeds, past all the rush hour traffic, tears streaming down my face because I knew she was dead, and all I could think about was, please don't be murdered. Please don't be murdered. I couldn't deal with that, and she wasn't. And she took her life, and it was very challenging, I have to say. But in the same way that my mum, same way that I tried to make mum's death a positive thing when she died by telling myself there's something positive here, I quite quickly found myself saying the same thing when Sonia died in order for me to deal with it. And I told myself, she's with my mum now, she's no longer going through pain, she's in a better place, all those things, and thinking or believing those things helped me deal with it. But I tell you, I'd give up everything to have her back. And I will say, one of the comforting things, Damien, is that on three occasions now I've had communication through one form or another from my sister, which has given me so much comfort to know that she actually has gone on to other place. She is with my mum, and it's just opened my mind to the kind of the spiritual journey that we're all on, well, that I'm on. And I can't wait to see her again.
Wow. And the whole spiritual aspect, was it something that you'd been connected to before that, or is it really something that's just opened as a result of that experience?
Well, without knowing it, I think, as a child, you see, laying in bed and telling myself that I'm going to help people around the world, where did that come from? You know, is it because my spirit knew that one day I would write a book that gets published around the world, and that people would email me to tell me that they've been inspired by reading about my challenges? Maybe maybe my spirit knew that. So maybe I have been aware of my spiritual journey right from the start, but I don't suppose I could articulate it, which I don't think we can we? But now that Sonia's gone, and because of the communication I've had from her, it's all falling into place that actually, I was right as a child. I did know that was going to help people around the world, and I've gone on to do that. It's a strange old world we live in. There's been other things that's happened along the way, some incredible coincidences between me and my sister Sonia, which links back to my mum. But when I actually look back at life now and look at all those incredible coincidences, it actually does confirm that, there's more to this life than we can possibly imagine. And maybe I always chose to have this life anyway.
Yeah. Now, with your work today as a motivational speaker, you travel around and you have the opportunity to share your story with people in the schooling system. You were mentioning prisons as well, in the corporate world as well. And I guess out of it, you've got a thing called the I Can philosophy. And I was just wondering if you could share with listeners what exactly the I Can philosophy is and how it actually... how you actually share that with the world?
Well, I think that I can. When I'm speaking, and not just when I'm speaking, I'm explaining to you, I think I can are the two most important words in the English language, and those two words have helped me deal with what I've been through, and have enabled me to shape the kind of life that I want. Because if you saw me speak, you would not believe that 4.5 years ago, it was one of my biggest fears, and it has always been one of my biggest fears. But 4.5 years ago, I asked a psychologist at a conference, when will I be able to put my past behind me and be able to speak in front of people? And I didn't mean to big audiences in the many, many hundreds. I meant just in like little workshop groups. You know, we all get that little thumping of the heart when it's like when you're giving your words of introduction. Well, I asked this psychologist this, and he said to me, Richard, you might just have to accept that you're as good as you're going to get. And I said, no, I can overcome this fear. And, you know, when I am speaking, and I'm saying it, I'll say it now, the conversations that we have with ourselves are probably the most important conversations we'll ever have. Because I didn't listen to him, because I said, I can, it's now what I do. And then last year I spoke to 30,000 people. Actually, I feel like I should write back to that psychologist and explain how I actually got wrong. Going back to my spiritual journey and choosing this life, my name is Richard McCam. There is an I in Richard. There is Cam in McCam. It's almost like I was given this name to go and share this message and talk about adopting this I Can attitude. And in fact, I have this like little acronym, you know, I Can. I is the importance of having goals. C is conquering your fears. A is asking for help, and M is never giving up. And those are the kind of the tools and the things that I've applied in my life to help me go from, I suppose, being written off as a child to now, you know, without sounding cheesy, being written about. You know, it's. I guess that's my kind of philosophy. It's just the belief that you can do whatever it is you want in life.
Well, now, Richard, I mentioned earlier on that we've had streams of questions from people all around the world, and I'm just going to go through some of them now. I have a question from Michelle in New Zealand, and Michelle asks, do you ever get to the point where it's just plain sailing? Feels to me like all I ever do is overcome adversity in varying degrees.
Do I ever get to a point where I feel like it's plain sailing? Well, yes, I do. Yes, I do. I mean, life, for me, I mean, it's not all been black. It's not all been doom and gloom. There have been times in my life where it has felt like things are coming together. It's plain sailing. When I joined the army, I thought it was all coming together, but then I got kicked out. I got my job when I came out of the army. It was coming together. I bought myself a house, but then I got involved in drugs, and bang, it happened again. Life took another detour, came out of prison, I saved my house at the last minute, and it was all coming together, and then something else happened. I think, this is my opinion, looking back, and I'm 40 now, when I look back at my life, it's like the tide. It's the ebb and flow of life. We will have challenging situations from time to time. 2 years ago, I thought I was in the best place ever. You know, I'm doing a job that I love. I'm making a difference. Isn't that what we all want to do? It's all coming together, and bang, once again, something happens that I wasn't expecting. My sister Sonia stabbed her boyfriend. Sorry, that was my sister takes a life. I'm thinking about when she stabbed her boyfriend. My sister takes a life. I wasn't expecting that, and it was all coming together. And I'm in a better place now. So in answer to the question, I think that from time to time, we will have these setbacks and these obstacles and these challenges to deal with along the way. And I think it's just part of life. One of the things that I believe now is that we can survive those things. We can survive whatever life throws at us. And actually, when those adverse conditions are thrown in front of you, they will give you a strength. And they're giving me a strength and an understanding of situations that I wouldn't have had I not been through them. So, I don't know if that helps, Michelle, but...
I think it's a very, very powerful response.
I think just accepting that life will have its ebb and flow is just something we have to accept, and we can't do anything about those things, but what we can do is decide how we'll respond to them, to those things, I suppose.
Mm.
Until the next one happens.
Yeah, that's an excellent answer. Okay, Richard, this one's from Amrita in the United Kingdom. And Amrita asks, I'm facing massive challenges. I'm strong and believe in myself, but am easily affected emotionally by other people's rudeness and ignorance towards me. How can I be grounded and remain strong when I feel so emotionally fragile?
Yeah, other people's rudeness and ignorance, I can relate to that. It reminds me of where I used to work before I got the help that I needed, where I had a boss that was very rude towards me. And I mean, what used to happen is I felt very emotionally fragile, shall I say, but somebody gave me a book to read, and it was, I can't remember the title, but it was about transactional analysis. And what transactional analysis tells us is that in certain situations, we're behaving like a child or an adult or a parent. It all kind of made sense to me, because when my boss has been rude and arrogant or ignorant towards me, I was behaving like a little child. I was behaving or feeling how I felt when my dad was rude towards me. And so when I kind of grasped that, I then realised, no, I need to be an adult. I'm an adult here. I'm nearly 30 years old when this was taking place. We're talking 10 years ago. And the next time that this person was rude to me, I kind of stood up to them. I said, I'm really sorry, but I'm not prepared for you to speak to me like this. She was not expecting that, and she flew off the handle. I just took myself away from that environment. So I guess in answer to that question, and only because I've been there, how I dealt with it was by realising that I am an adult and understanding what I'm not prepared to put up with. And if someone is being rude and ignorant towards somebody, you don't have to put up with that, and tell that person. And if it gets into a very, if they get violent, not violent, if they're going to start shouting and bawling, take you away from that situation. But I have to say, it's not just as easy as reading a book. I have had help along the way. 10 years ago, I had 2.5 years of counselling, and then I went on to get some psychoanalysis. Now, that was probably a four-year period. So for 4 years, I had to go through everything that was an issue for me. But I learned something very, very important at the end of that, and that was there is nothing wrong with asking for help. I wish I'd have got the help that a traumatised child would need, having been through what I've been through. And I wish I'd have not left it as late as I did. So in answer to that question, get some help and remember that you are an adult and be prepared to say that I'm not going to put up with this.
That's a great response.
Damien, can I just say something?
Just when you were saying that, Richard, like I know that the world has changed radically, and it's almost quite amazing to have the kind of different support structures that are out there now with counselling and coaching and psychotherapy. I was just wondering, were those tools there available to you as a child, or is it something that's just been a recent phenomenon that that we're blessed with these kind of tools to help us deal with difficult circumstances?
Yeah, good question. Was that kind of help available in the, what it happened, we're talking about the 1970s when it was happening
to
me. Well, going back to the book I mentioned, the one on transactional analysis, I'm sure that is a book that was around the time I was a child, and I'm sure counselling's been here for many, many years. But what I do suspect is if there was any offer of help to us as children, my dad being the person that he was, would not have allowed that. So I think, I mean, that's a different message for a different audience. You know, sometimes I speak to social workers, I think often children need to be listened to, and I don't think we got that. And if somebody would have sat me down, somebody that I felt I could trust and cared for me, I probably would have told them that I was having these, I mean, I haven't even shared that with you, but I was having murderous thoughts as a child. I needed somebody to talk to, and unfortunately, provision wasn't made for us. It wasn't until, obviously, late 20s, 30s that I got the help that I needed.
Yeah.
But it's more commonplace now, and you know, I think it's acceptable, much more acceptable than it was many years ago.
Yeah. And it must be quite something for you to actually go into schools now and share your story and let kids know that there are options for them as well.
You're right. I mean, one of my favourite audiences is young people, especially if they're, you know, at risk of being disengaged, because they can relate to me and I can relate to them. And I see what I've been through as a gift to enable me to do that, to then go on and help other people, not just people in schools, but, you know, because I speak to a whole range of different audiences and age ranges, and it's the same message. You know, we all need to kind of step up and be the incredible person we were born to be. We know we're walking miracles and we just don't know it.
My sentiments exactly. Now, we've got a question here from Steve in the United States, and Steve asks, why do I have nothing but adversity and never any successes?
Why do I have nothing but adversity and never any successes? I'm not quite sure how old Steve is, but I mean, if Steve was online, I would challenge Steve about the language he's using, because I suspect he will have had some successes along the way. Learning the English language, for one, his email came in English, so he's learned one of the most complicated languages on the planet. Probably can walk, which is, I've got children now. I know it's very difficult. My son, who's 14 months, he's falling down, banging his head, he's full of bruises, but he gets back up again. So I'm sure Steve's had that success, and if he hasn't, he may have ridden a bike or learned to swim. So he's had some successes. But when I listen to that question, I think, well, what is success? Steve, what does success look like for you? What would need to be happening for you to say that's a success in my life? And I would ask him to write down even just one thing. If I was doing that, if that was happening, that would mean I'm successful. And then ask himself, see, we know the answer to everything. And then ask himself, what would I need to do to make that happen in my life? And then take those first few steps along that path. You see, your subconscious is incredible. And if you just ask himself, how would I be successful? He'll tell himself. It might not work out straight away, but we all know, don't we, that setbacks and failure is related to success. You need a few failures along the way to be a success. I mean, when I got my book first published, I got rejected about 40 times.
Wow.
But I kept going. I didn't give up. J.K. Rowling, who wrote all the Harry Potter books, took her over a year to get a publisher interested. They're all turning her down. She's now worth $500 million. So sometimes to get those successes, you've got to accept there'll be a few knockbacks along the way.
Yeah. I guess it makes the successes all the more sweeter when you have overcome challenging circumstances.
Definitely.
Great.
but if Steve believes that he has nothing but adversity in his life, you know what, if that's what he believes, that's what he'll make happen. We have to believe that we can actually have other things. If I believe that I can make a success of my life, well, my brain will work out a way to actually achieve that. And I guess Steve just needs to be careful with the kind of things he's saying to himself. Cool. Cheers, Steve.
Okay, that's a great response. Okay, this one's from Caro in the United Kingdom. I seem to have a deep-seated block or belief that I'm never good enough, which I feel is something which has been with me since childhood and results from having a very critical father. Although I know all this intellectually, I find that it still colours my life in a negative way emotionally and always seems to put the brakes on my dreams and aspirations. What do you suggest as a way of overcoming this?
I think she mentioned the crucial thing there. She feels that it's something to do with her childhood, and very often the things that are stopping us being incredible and achieving those dreams and aspirations is things that's taking place in our childhood. And I think it's good to spend a bit of time to understand that. But I think it's quite common for people to sabotage their dreams or to push them to one side, thinking that I can't achieve that. And you know, whatever you do, like you're never going to achieve them. I think what's done it for me. I mean, one of my biggest achievements was making a success of the speaking, something I've always been fearful of. Now, so that was my dream. So one of the ways that I've made it happen, is I've taken that leap of faith. I was at university studying, actually, to be a social worker. This is just 4 years ago, started 5 years ago. So I was into my second year at university. And in order for me to achieve my dreams, I set this goal, you see, to be this inspirational speaker. I want to speak around the world. In order for me to do that, I closed the door behind me, and I had spent over £50,000 funding my degree, because I had obviously mortgage payments, etc. So because I'd made that commitment and walked away, I had to make it happen. Now, I don't know what Caro could do that would look like commitment to her, but that's one of my, I guess, great pieces of advice, is to commit to doing something and close that door behind you so that you have to do it and you have to make it happen. There's no way that I can't make this speaking career happen for me because I've got a wife and I've got children now. So it has to happen, and there's no way it's not going to. And I guess know that if you take that leap of faith, that whatever happens, you'll be able to cope with it. You know, you'll be able to cope with it. And I guess I wish Caro every success in going for their dreams and aspirations. I would like to have known what they were.
Numerous different people say that life will never throw a challenge at you that you don't actually have the ability to meet and to overcome. Has that been your experience in your own life and in working with other people?
On reflection, I can say that, yes, I think life's only given me what I'm able to cope with. And I can only say that because I'm stood up now, because I'm sort of as I speak, but because I'm standing and I'm living a good life now, so that's why I can say that. But when those things were happening to me, it was really difficult for me to think that way. When my sister first died, I wasn't thinking that, oh, I've only been given this because I can cope with it. I was devastated. But, you know, as time's gone on, I have been able to deal with it. I have been able to deal with my mum's death. So I kind of can agree with that now. But at the time, it's difficult to understand.
Cool. That's a good response. Okay, this one's from Naina. I hope I've actually pronounced that properly. And she's in the United Kingdom. And Naina asks, what happens when you feel like you've had a breakthrough and then it comes back again? How to stop oneself falling into the same trap over and over? The speed with which the old habit or response resurfaces is amazing sometimes. Any fresh wisdom on this would be welcome. Thanks and love.
That's interesting. The over and over again, which is something I can relate to. I mean, what I haven't shared with you is the amount of relationships I've had in my life. And, you know, and I'm not ashamed to say, but I've had probably 250 relationships in my life for a couple of reasons. One, I've always been trying to replace the love that I lost when I lost my mum. And secondly, so I've always needed to be in a relationship. But secondly, when I was in a relationship, I was so convinced that when she discovers who I am, she'd be out the door straight away. So I was convinced that she would leave me. So I kind of brought the relationship to an end. And it always started the same. I'd always meet somebody, oh, this is the one for me, we're going to get married. It was all great around the honeymoon period. 3 or 4 weeks in, the cracks started to show. And then I'd start getting insecure. Then I'd start thinking that she was going off and having affairs. And it happened again and again and again. So I can relate to that thing resurfacing and going over and over again. How did I deal with that? I think, getting the help. I mean, there's a bit of a theme forming tonight. You got me asking and getting help. It definitely helped me. But I think I became more confident in the last, 8 or 10 years, mixing with a more positive group of people, making big changes, got the counselling, got the therapy. And I have to say that I'm not saying today that I'm where I want to be. Still things happen. You know, there's little challenges that come my way, and, you know, my wife's a great support to me, and she can help me deal with situations. But I just feel as though being aware of why these things keep reoccurring, why I was insecure. I mean, the counselling helped me, you know, and I mean, understanding that I was trying to replace mum's love, understanding that I was then being insecure and I was seeing things that weren't actually happening. You know, when you believe something, you can tell yourself crazy things. I mean, my girlfriends would go out with their mates for a drink and I'd think they're going out having affairs, and I was convinced. So, I don't think there's any fresh wisdom, which is what she's asking, but just the way that I dealt with those reoccurring insecurities was, one, getting help, mixing with a positive support group, and understanding why they were happening. And obviously, you know, mainly it'll know why they're happening herself. Maybe she needs to spend some time, I guess, looking at what's happening, what's reoccurring. And the very fact that she realises it's reoccurring and it's a pattern means she's halfway there. But maybe she needs to sit down with some professional and discuss it and really get to the root cause of why these things keep happening. Because, you know, when they do, you're not aware of it. You've got to sit down and take some time out, I guess, and reflect on those things and try and tackle it, which is what I've done, I think. I'm so glad that I'm in the position I am, because I used to feel so insecure, and now I don't.
Yeah, I think that quality of awareness really is remarkable. It's one of my favourite quotes is awareness is curative. So just becoming aware of a pattern or a cycle of behaviour can in itself be curative alone, because often we're running around in these cycles and have no real awareness about what's going on. But
she's halfway there, but yeah, you know, she needs a little bit extra help.
Yeah, I think just coming to the realisation is a fantastic start along that journey. Great. Okay, so this is a question from Avinish in South Africa. And Avinish's question is, how do you keep focused on your dreams in difficult times?
How do you keep focused on dreams in difficult times? Well, I can only answer this by, you know, what's happened in the last few years of life. Because I have to say that, although I'm now fully aware of the importance of having goals in our lives and kind of shaping the life that we want, as a young person, I didn't have those kind of goals. It's only like in recent years that I've kind of embraced all that. But what I will say is, just look at my goal now is to go out and inspire as many people as I can by using my experiences and putting them to good use. Right, so that's my goal, or my dream. The difficult time for me, which is what Avinash said, was I think my sister killing herself. Now, when that happened, all my dreams, all my goals were completely forgotten about. And I guess what I'm saying there is we can have our dreams if we accept that difficult things will come along whilst we're pursuing our dreams. I think it's okay to take some time out to deal with those difficult things and maybe put our goals and our dreams and aspirations to one side, because they're always going to be there. Once you've got them, they're there in your heart. And I guess just deal with each difficult experience as it comes along. And you can't do everything all the time, you know. So I guess when Sonia died, it's only just over a year ago, all my focus, you know, was on her. I had to arrange a funeral and everything else. And the speaking just was forgotten about. But once it was all dealt with and then I started to put things back together again, I could then slowly but surely start pursuing my dreams and continue down the path that I've taken, I suppose, in the last few years. So it's okay to have difficult times, just kind of put your aspirations to one side for a moment and then get back onto them, because they're not going to go away.
Mm.
I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's great. Look, it sounds like just having a real empathy for yourself, just as you navigate your way through life.
Don't be too hard on yourself.
Yeah. I think it's a very, very important distinction. I think often we're our own harshest critics and judges and just creating that container or environment to just allow space to deal with life as it comes up is really, really powerful and profound.
Sure.
Okay, this question comes from Brian, and Brian's in the United States. And Brian asks, what role does trust play in overcoming adversity?
Trust. Well, my take on that question is quite a new development for me, I think. Because what I would say now is trust. I trust now that the adversity that's happened in my life is all part of the big plan. It's all part of what I'm here for. It was all part of the bigger picture. I didn't know that, or I wasn't aware that I knew that as I went through those difficult times. I know it now, even more so now that Sonia's gone and that she's communicated with me. So I think if we trust ourselves that adversity is going to make us stronger and that we chose this life and there will be something positive to come from that adversity, well, I think that's, well, for one, it's helped me. But I think, even though I say it's a recent development in my kind of awareness, I think I knew it all along. I think I knew it as a young boy when I told myself I'd help people around the world. So there's some kind of trust there, trust in the bigger picture, although I didn't understand it fully or as much as I do now. So I think trust is important in overcoming adversity. Trust that one, it's all part of the bigger picture, but also that we're incredible. You know, the human race has been here for so long because it's a survival. The species has survived because it can deal with adverse conditions. And just trust that we're part of this incredible human race and that we're all, as I said earlier, we're all walking miracles. So I think trust is important.
Mm. When I actually take a moment out of my own life and think about just how remarkable it is that we're all sort of walking on this rock that's sort of hurtling out through space at great speeds, it's phenomenal that we're even alive and just to see every single breath, every single moment as an absolute miracle in and of itself without anything else transpiring. Often it's difficult to contextualise it when we're sort of so immersed in our own experience, but literally when that perspective is taken out a little bit and you see what it is that's unfolding here on Earth, it really is remarkable.
It's funny you should say that, because even just today I found myself looking up at the moon, and yeah, we're all aware that, you know, the planet, the solar system, but I just found myself taking a few seconds to think, hang on a minute, how on Earth is that there? You know, it's where did it all end? It's just like it's miraculous and just so far-reaching and like too deep, and we just can't obviously contextualize it. But I found myself just thinking about how on Earth is that moon up there? Anyway,
I was just wondering, just a question from me, Richard. What is it today that you like most about your work, in terms of going around and speaking and sharing your story?
The difference that I know that I can make in other people's lives, because I tell you what, for every single person that it does make a difference in hearing my story, and there's many, I could tell you many occasions where people have, well, it's been helped by it. It just means for every single one of those, it means that my mum's death was not in vain. So that's why I love what I do. You don't get that or have that kind of impact when you're stacking shelves in Morrison's or, you know, digging the roads. So I feel like I'm privileged of being able to do what I want to do. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad I didn't listen to that person that told me to accept that, you know, just accept I'm as good as I'm going to get, you know, 4 years ago. So that's what I love about what I do. And I don't even see it as a job. You know, speaking is not a job. It's just something I love doing, and, you know, hopefully I can continue doing it. And hopefully, you know, my grand design and my big vision is to speak around the world, and hopefully one day that will happen.
Yeah, great. And in terms of the destinations of where you'd most like to speak, do you have anywhere in mind then?
You see, I haven't, and that's I'm my own worst enemy there, because when I speak about goal setting, one of the things I have to say is your goals have got to be clearly defined. So my goal of speaking around the world is not clearly defined, and maybe I should spend some time and take a page out of my own book and think about where it is, just exactly where it is I want to speak. So thank you there for helping me along my journey.
Not sure, but like your message is so powerful. I think it's like universally like to actually to be able to share it. And this one of the beautiful things about these teleseminars is just their global nature and people being able to participate from all around the world. And I guess seeing from sitting from where I sit each week and seeing the questions that come in, like we're all sharing this human experience together, and the actual challenges and hurdles to overcome, they're literally week to week, they're universal. It doesn't matter what country you live in, what colour you are, what creed you are. Literally, the actual similarities in the raw emotions that we deal with as humans is it really is uniting, I guess, in many, many ways.
Yeah.
So,
of course, you do this all the time. It's the first time that I've took part, but when I've got these pages of questions that you know, this is the kind of question you're going to get, Richard, they've all got a similar theme. So even just the questions I've been asked today, they've all got a similar theme. But if you're saying that it's the same every week, it speaks volumes, doesn't it? We're all going
amazing.
Through the same experiences.
it's amazing, just like whether it's on juicing or whether it's on exercise or coaching or psychology, or like literally we're all human, and we're all sharing this experience together. And I think it's just really inspiring just to actually make that known to people, and realizing that particularly with this call in particular, dealing with difficult circumstances can actually be very isolating for people. So it actually be sitting at home wherever you are in the world and just realizing that there are people out there that love you and care about you, and we're all sharing this experience together. That thought alone can be really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and I have to say, I went through my early life believing that I was the only one that had, you know, issues with this, that, or whatever. And it was so, I guess, liberating, the word I'm going to use again. As I grew up and became a young adult, when I started having relationships and getting to know people and realising that actually they've got some issues with this and she's got issues with that, and I realise they've all got these things going on because it's part of life. So I no longer feel like that isolation you talk about. Anything what I do, I can help people understand that. Well, you know, once again, it's just an incredible gift to be able to do that and to share that. And of course, I'm not the only one. There's I come across many, many people who've had similar journeys to me, who've kind of inspired me.
Yeah, yeah. Who are some of the people that have inspired your life?
In my hometown, there was a lady called Jane Tomlinson who was given 12 months to live. She was dying of cancer in the year 2000, and she went on to do some incredible things. You know, she raised £1.75 million for cancer charities, and she did a triathlon. She cycled one side of America to the other, and she did all these amazing things. And actually, she didn't die in 12 months' time. She died in 2007, and
wow.
You know, I believe she did that because of her focus and her motivation and her determination to not accept that, I guess, that dreadful news. So she inspires me. But I think the person that really, really inspired me is a man called W. Mitchell, who's a world famous speaker who's had two catastrophes in his life. He crashed a bike and was kind of burnt throughout his body. He lost his fingers, they burnt away and scarred it over his face. And then he recovered, and then he went on to crash his plane and became paralysed. Now, I heard him speaking about 3 years ago, and when I saw him on stage, it was November the 5th, I think it was, 2006. I was at university, and when I saw him on stage, I said, is what I'm on this planet for. I'm going to do that. And I walked away from university the following week. And as I said earlier in the call, I shut that door behind me. I walked away, and I just made it happen. And last year, well, it's 32,000 people, 180 engagements, and I will achieve that goal one day, speaking around the world. And so I guess he's been my greatest inspiration with regards to what it is I want to do.
Yeah, he's like, I can highly agree with you on that as well. I saw him speak
have you seen
in
him?
London a couple of times. He's a phenomenal inspiration.
Incredible.
Just to deal with the setbacks that he had in his life and to stand up and to inspire people all around the world, it's really quite amazing what you can do when you just apply yourself and be, I guess, the willingness to share your experience with other people is a really big part of that.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, that's what it's all about. In fact, my latest book, I'm on my third book now, is actually called The ICANN Chronicles, of which W. Mitchell's in it. And it's a collection of stories from other people, not just me, but other people that have overcome their own challenges and have had what I call an ICANN moment. You know, where they've had to find that courage to take that leap of faith. So that whole book is exactly what you just said. It's other people inspiring other people. Because I tell you what, the ripples in that pond, hopefully will be. I mean, look at W. Mitchell. He inspired me to walk away from university, which then led me to speak to 32,000 people last year. You know, had he not been doing that, maybe I wouldn't have stepped up as soon as I did. It's just incredible what we can do, and hopefully that book will inspire many, many other people. In fact, I've been inspired by reading the stories that people have shared with me.
Yeah.
So there's lots of incredible people out there.
Yeah, it's an amazing to actually feel like in a very similar process, actually, with the call, just to be able to meet and interview inspiring people and actually share those conversations as well. It's amazing when you can actually collect people's experiences and offer them to the world. So, like, I really look forward to your next book.
Thank you.
Now, Richard, we're actually coming very close to the end of the hour, and I just wanted to take this opportunity to really open-heartedly say thank you so much for not only sharing the last hour with us, but for actually just committing to stepping up and overcoming all the hurdles that life has thrown at you to get out there and share your message with the world. It's certainly a much better place for it, and I have no doubt that the path ahead of you is going to be a very, very exciting one. And I guess I was just wondering, like, for people who have been listening at home, I have no doubt that they want to find out more about you and to stay in touch with you. And I was just wondering if, firstly, you could actually share how they can learn more about you, and also in terms of helping you as well. Like, I think you've got a very powerful message. Is there ways that people may actually be able to open up opportunities in other parts of the world for you as well with your speaking?
Well, thank you for saying those nice things as well. It's been a pleasure, and it's been great for you to have me on here. And, you know, so I thank you from the bottom of my heart for being able to share my journey tonight. If people want to get hold of me, they can via my website, which is Richard McCann, and McCann is McCann, richardmccann.co.uk. And, you know, I mentioned it in the call, one of my big goals is to speak around the world, so if other people out there may know of opportunities where I could get to do that, please feel free to drop me a line. And I guess lastly, I am compiling this book, The ICANN Chronicles, at the moment. If there are people out there that have had their own ICANN moments where they'd like to share that with the world, please feel free to drop me a line. It'd be a pleasure to, you know, to read them and to consider them for the book, and let's help make the world a better place.
Awesome. Thanks, sir, Richard. Now, I was just wondering, in closing, just bringing the whole call together, if you had some closing words of advice for people who are sitting at home, maybe working through a challenge or two of their own, just any final closing words to inspire them to better things?
Well, I guess one thing I would say, and I kind of often finish this when I'm giving my talks, is if I can overcome the challenges that I had, and I'm nobody special, you know, abused as a child, given drugs in and out of children's homes, foster homes, mum was murdered by a serial killer, you know, beaten by my father, less school, no qualifications, no self-esteem, damaged goods, kicked out of the army, turned to drugs, went to prison, you know, found a man that hung himself, almost took my own life. If I can't overcome all that in my life and gone to, I guess, B, D, do achieve more than I ever dreamt possible. If I can, within you listening in tonight, can too. That's what I'd like to leave you.
Well, thanks, Richard. Well, I've certainly just grown tremendously in the past hour. Have no doubt whatsoever that people at home have had a similar experience. And thank you once again for sharing this with us, Richard.
And thank you. Thanks very much, David. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and I'll hopefully speak to you again in the near future.
Cool. And thank you also to everyone at home. Just you sending in your questions each week and fully participating in this process is total inspiration to me, and it's just a real pleasure to be of service to you all in this way. This call will actually be made available tomorrow on the peopleyoushouldmeet.com website for free. Please feel free to revisit it, and we also have a comment feature on the page now with a new website, so please do share your comments and how this call has actually affected you. Thanks again, Richard, and thank you everyone, and good evening.
All the best. Cheers, Damien.
Take care.